You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody, it's Ken. Just a quick question. Are you enjoying the podcast? Because if you are, can I ask you one favor? Just email the podcast to one friend who loves theater. If we all do that, we'll spread the words of these very, very smart people who've given their valuable time to come on the podcast for our own enjoyment and education, and it would mean a lot to them and a lot to me. So spread the word about the podcast with one email to one theater friend of your choice. And now, on with this week's episode.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I'm Ken Davenport. I'm very excited to have an incredibly talented composer on the show today, one of the young guns of Broadway. Please welcome the Tony-nominated Mr. Matthew Sklar. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So Matt's the composer of the Broadway productions of The Wedding Singer, as well as Elf the Musical. He's also the composer of two new musicals waiting in that queue for a Broadway theater, Halftime and The Prom, which has got a rave review out of town. So, Matt, tell me, what was your first encounter with the theater, your first date, if you will?
Let's see. I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I grew up in New Jersey, and my parents took us to a matinee of Annie, and it was Sarah Jessica Parker as Annie, so I believe it was about 1980, and that was my first experience sitting in a Broadway house, and I just remember being mesmerized and just loving it. And then we would come into the city every once in a while because we lived so close. Then a few years later, and I was probably around 8 years old, my older sister did a local production, right? Like in a summer program. And that's when I got to see the same show 3 times in a row, sitting with my family. And that's when I sort of just kind of was really enamored by the process and then seeing my sister up there and, you know, all the musicians playing here, and I was just really blown away by it, and then I kind of got the theater bug, and then I couldn't wait until I was old enough to be part of that. So I had to wait 3 years, but then I auditioned, and then I started being a part of that program, which was really an amazing experience.
And when did the love of music happen for you? Were you always a musician?
Yeah, I started playing the piano actually when I was 2 years old. My dad is a dentist, but he worked his way through dental school by playing in wedding and bar mitzvah bands. So my parents actually met at a wedding. My mom was a guest. My dad was playing the accordion, I think. The accordion? Okay, Dad. Whatever. So my dad would play the piano all the time. And I apparently loved when he would play the song Jingle Bells. And I would make him play over and over and over again. And then apparently one day I sat down in a diaper and plunked out Jingle Bells on the keyboard with one finger. And everybody looked at each other and said, what the hell is that all about? And then they started me on lessons when I was 4. And I did the kind of traditional classical music training starting from the age of 4.
So were you really one of those like musical prodigy kids? Did it come very easy to you?
You know, I hated practicing so much, which is something I regret a bit because I had a really good ear, but I didn't want to sit with the music because it was boring to me. So I wanted to make up my own stuff. So I would listen to recordings of what I'm supposed to be practicing in my lesson, and I would get by my ear. So I didn't really learn to read and write music until when I was 9th or 10th grade, when I really wanted to look at this as a profession. I cheated a lot, is what I'm saying. But I love, you know, all different kinds of music. And then my love for the theater all kind of happened, you know, in junior high. And then I started being in shows constantly. Started doing community theater when I was 11. Then I would have a school show in the spring and a summer show with this. So I was doing three musicals a year, basically.
As an actor.
But what was happening was that I was inundating myself with cast albums. So I was learning them, and I was obsessed with them, and I could play them from memory. I would go, you know, I remember I was in a production of Shenandoah. That was the first community theater production thing I did. And I just knew the song, so I would help play rehearsals. And I was really little. I was a little kid, but I could pick it up. So it was a, you know, I kind of realized early on that marrying music and theater is something that is very special for me, and that's something I just became pretty obsessed with.
And you said that when you were in high school, you started to think about it as a profession. Mm-hmm. Did you say, I'm going to be a composer? That's what I'm going to do? Was that the profession you set out?
Well, a couple of things happened when I was 14 and 15. And when I was 14 years old, my junior high music teacher asked me to write a song for the choir. And I'd never really written anything that was performed by anybody else. It was my first try doing that. So I wrote the song, did it at the graduation, you know, the final concert, and everybody really liked it. And with my bar mitzvah money, I had bought a four-track recorder that lived in the basement. And I made a demo of this song, kind of a pop version of the song, with just me, you know, playing piano and with a little drum machine and me singing it. And I made this, and it was in the days of cassettes. So I sent this cassette to the production company of the new Mickey Mouse Club, which was on the Disney Channel, because they had just started and every day they did a musical number. So I said, why not? I'll just send it to them. And about a month later, they called and said, we love your song. We want to do the song on the show. We're going to fly you down. We want to interview you on the show. We want to give you a little award thing. So basically every Friday on the show, they would do a segment on two kids that were doing something a little out of the norm. So that Friday, it was me and Christy Yamaguchi, the ice skater.
So, is this on YouTube somewhere?
The song is on YouTube. I put on my own Instagram at the very end, me looking into the camera and saying, see you real soon. They made me do that. It was the most horrifying thing. I was terrified. But what was amazing was going to that rehearsal and sitting on a professional soundstage and watching a bunch of professional people working on a song and staging a song that I made up in my head in my house when I was, you know, 14 years old. And that was the moment where I was like, okay, I want to do this. I want to do this. There's nothing like it. And then it aired. So that was going into 10th grade. So I was 14. And then when I was 15, only a few months later, I found out that Marvin Hamlisch was doing a concert on my 15th birthday in the theater where I was in all those community theater shows. So I just wanted to meet him because we spent my entire childhood listening to Chorus Line and playing our song. And, you know, we had those cast albums on rotation in the car. So I really just wanted to meet him and get his autograph, really. And what happened was the really nice lady who ran the theater was there to welcome Marvin. And he was just there with it was just himself and a drummer. And that's all there was. So he did his little sound check. And my job was to be an assistant to the ushers. So I was helping the ushers stuff programs. And Marvin finished his sound check, and then all of a sudden the doors burst open to the lobby where I was. And he said, where's Matthew? Where's Matthew? And I just raised my hand, and he said, I hear you play the piano. I got a really nice one on stage. Why don't you go play? So I was not expecting this, but I went on stage, and I played a song from They're Playing Our Song, which is one of my favorite songs. And that went well, and then I played a song that I wrote, and I sang a song I wrote. I don't know why I did it, but I just went for it. And then while I was doing that, he started improvising on top. We played four hands on this song that I had just written. And then he said, hey, can you play If You Really Knew Me again, but can you do it in B flat instead of G? And I knew the song well enough to transpose it. So I transposed it, and it was sort of humming along to me. And he said, how old are you? And the lady from the theater was like, it's his birthday today. He's 15. And Marvin said, do you want to be in the show tonight? I ended up being in the show with him. After he finished, I believe my cue was Ice Castle. I was supposed to go in the past door backstage. And then he gave this introduction about how he met me. And he was hilarious because he was brilliant. He was a brilliant comedian. I came on stage. I accompanied him. He interviewed me on stage for a second. And we did the song. And then it was a really this kind of an incredible evening. And afterwards, we stayed in touch. And anytime he was in New Jersey, I always got to go back and visit him. He ended up writing me a college recommendation letter. He spoke to my parents at length about where I should go to college. And then when I was here, because he said, I think you should go to NYU if you want to be a composer. Because at that time, I knew I wanted to be a composer, certainly after the Disney experience. He said, you need to meet directors and writers. He said, if you go to conservatory, it's just going to be a lot of concert music. He's like, you'll be fine. Said, you've got to make those relationships. And it was an incredible thing he did for me. And when I was living at the dorm, he was rehearsing something and he said, hey, I'm at 890 Broadway. Why don't you come up, hang out? So I hung out with him for just the day, just shadowed him. And he was just really kind.
And a lot of your early career was as a rehearsal pianist on a lot of shows, right?
Yeah. Well, after I met Marvin, I just wanted to do whatever Marvin did. So I knew that he was a rehearsal pianist at 18. So I was like, I want to be a rehearsal pianist. I want to go be a Broadway rehearsal pianist. And then also he went to Juilliard pre-college. So the next year I auditioned for Juilliard pre-college and went there for my junior and senior year of high school. So every Saturday I would take a full day of courses. And what's amazing is that directly from Juilliard, I met somebody who had worked on Broadway a lot, and their former assistant was conducting Les Mis on Broadway, and introduced me to the then music director of Broadway, Broadway Les Mis. And I met this guy, and all of a sudden, I was subbing on Broadway as a keyboardist my freshman year of college. So I was living at Hayden Hall down at NYU.
What a dumb
play. Oh, hello. My God. I can smell the weed now. Am I allowed to say that? It was an amazing experience. And I got to do that mostly because I was living in New York and I was available. Every Broadway musician is looking for good subs. And especially if they're young and available and they can do it, you're gold. So after I played my first performance of Les Mis, they needed subs at Miss Saigon. It was a lot of the same music department. So then all of a sudden I was sent over there. So I spent many years as a rehearsal pianist and then ultimately a conductor at both of those shows. And it was really great learning.
And I remember the first time I heard your name was with the show called The Rhythm Club, right?
Yeah.
That was where I feel like you burst out onto the scene as this demo started to make its way around all these offices. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, how that came to be.
Well, I met my writing partner, Chad Beglin, when I was 19. So this was about almost 24 years ago we met. And we'd written two shows that had readings, and our first show had like a reading, and we didn't have the rights to it. We learned that lesson really fast. And then it was E.M. Forster's Morris. Chad always wanted to do that. But what we didn't know is that it was the only novel that E.M. Forster wrote that was not in the public domain. And we just didn't know. But we wrote it, and it was a great learning experience, and we got to see it. And then we wrote another show. We went the other direction and did an adaptation of Oedipus, which is this wacky Oedipus thing in a film noir. But we had this great cast. We did it with Lynette Perry and Jan Maxwell and Mary Bond Davis, and all these incredible people were in this production. That was our second show.
But by the way, I have to say that when I was 16 years old, I wrote a letter to Andrew Lloyd Webber saying, you should write a musical about Oedipus.
I love it.
Send me yours.
Listen,
we'll talk about it later.
You got it. It's on the way. That show had a jazz score, and Chad and I realized that we really liked working in that language. So Chad had come across this story, and it was really not a story, but it was a historical event of these kids in Hamburg, Germany in 1938 who were obsessed with American swing music. And it was illegal in Germany. You'd get arrested on the street for singing a disco tafted, literally. And these kids were risking their lives to pretend they were American and sing these songs. And we thought, wow, what an interesting idea for a musical. There was a movie that came out, but it's based on the same phenomenon, but it was we wrote our own story for it. So we started that, I'm going to say in 1996 or 1997. And we wrote four songs and we submitted it to the ASCAP Musical Theater Workshop that is run by Stephen Schwartz and Michael Kirker. We sent that show, and we sent the Oedipus show, which was then now called Wicked City, for the workshop to be considered. And Michael Kirker called and said, congratulations, you made the workshop. And we were thrilled, but we thought it was for the other show. And then finally, at the end of the phone call, I said, so which show? is it for? Because we submitted to. And he said, oh, it's for, and then it was called Swing Alley. We kind of lost all the blood in our faces because we realized we'd only written four songs. And for this workshop, we had to perform 45 minutes of the show continuously. So we got in, and we just had to write really quickly. And it was a great lesson, just having to deliver quickly. So it was, I think we had about 4 or 5 weeks to do it. And we had this great cast, and I was then working at Titanic as the associate music director. So I just called in a lot of favors to people to see who could be in our cast, and we had this great cast. It was like, we got like Alice Ripley and Clark Thorell, and all this amazing cast came on. And that show got us sort of on the map. And Billy Rosenfield used to run RCA Victor, was in the audience of that. And so were Beth Williams, who at the time, you know, we were working as fellow pit musicians. You know, Beth has gone on to be this big Broadway producer, but I was the keyboard two player. She was the keyboard one player for a while in Les Mis. So that's how I knew her. And then her husband, Alan Williams, were there and they optioned the show from us. And then we started really digging into it and doing readings, and we came really close to coming to Broadway, but we had the heartbreak that did not happen.
Yeah, and before we get to the heartbreak I just love, I mean, it sounds like obviously your background of being a pit musician and all these connections that you had really helped you get these shows noticed because of the cast, because of all the people.
Yeah, I think being in the pit of a show, especially if you're conducting a show, is the best seat in the house to see how a show is constructed. It's right in front of you. And you're kind of the heartbeat of the show. But also you can see how the set is moving, what needs to be accomplished in order for this piece of the set to be off, for this to come on, what music is needed to do that. Do I need a safety vamp? Do I need, you know, all these things on how shows are constructed. Being, you know, in a rehearsal pianist or a pit musician or a conductor is a great way to learn those things.
What I love about your story is that you wanted to be a composer, but you knew that there was a stepping stone to be that. So many people I know come here like, I want to be a composer. All of them are right.
Yeah. No, it took me 12 years. I spent 12 years in the pit, and then it took another two. I had to leave it, like really leave it, and then I finally was able to get a show here. So it was a 14-year process.
So your first show gets optioned for Broadway, comes very, very close. Doesn't happen.
Yeah.
What do you do when you get so close to it?
Well, I learned a lot of lessons. It was heartbreaking, I'm not going to lie. There's a picture of Chad and me with our billboard in Schubert Alley. We were up. We looked like the happiest little kids you've ever seen in your life. We had a theater, it was all announced, and money just fell through, and then all of a sudden, just like dominoes, each piece of it went down. Our out-of-town got canceled, and then they tried to sell it, and it just wasn't going to happen. You know, it was really devastating, to say the least. But I worked with Maury Yeston a bunch during Titanic. I was with him the whole way. I was the rehearsal pianist for the workshop and saw the show through Broadway for like the first year and a half. And he's always been a really good mentor. And I was obviously shaken up by everything. And he said to me, he's like, look, it happens to everybody. I'm sorry that this happened your first time. He said, but I think the lesson to be learned here is that I think you can't have just one show going on at once. You know, you can't have all your eggs in one basket, because if that thing doesn't happen, you're going to feel how you feel right now again, because it's going to happen again. It happens to all of us. It's happened to the best of us. And it was an important lesson to learn. I have to limit it. I can't take on 7 things. My brain can handle. I try to have 2 or 3 going at the same time. So if one stalls, I can focus on the other one. But I think it was a really important lesson to learn early on. And ever since then, I've tried to multitask a bit.
Did you think about giving up?
I'm going to say for about a year. I lived on 57th and 8th at the time, and I had to go back. The very kind people at Miss Saigon, you know, I believe they even threw me like a little congratulations goodbye party, that you're out of the pit, you're a composer now. And then it happened. I was like, you need any keyboard one subs? So I went back to work, but it was really difficult for me to come into Times Square and Schubert Alley, because that poster was up there for a few months. And I would literally walk by it just, I couldn't believe it was happening. I was so excited, and I was so, so innocent back then. And then, you know, it was hard to go walk into this neighborhood for a while. But then, and because directly because of Little Pub, you can really draw a straight line through all these projects. At the first reading of Rhythm Club, Alan Williams pulled me aside and said, Margot Lyne wants to talk to you and Chad. And we said, okay, and we knew who she was from Jelly's Last Jam, and this was probably 1998. She just said, I just want to let you guys know that I think you're incredibly talented, and I would love to work with you on something someday. Here's my card, and let's stay in touch. So we were blown away by that and stayed in touch with her. We would talk to her every once in a while. If we had an idea, we would meet for lunch like once or twice a year. And then she had this huge move of Hairspray. And at that time, we were still hoping that Rhythm Club might be able to find its way back to Broadway. And then once it was clear that it probably wasn't going to happen, Margot called us up, and now she had this big hit. And she said, I want to work with you guys, and let's find something. And at the same time, and this is sheer coincidence, Chad was pitching a screenplay to an executive at New Line Cinema named Mark Kaufman. And they were talking about the screenplay. And then all of a sudden, Mark kept saying, Chad, I know your name, and I don't know why. I don't know why. And then they realized the demo of Rhythm Club was sitting on his desk. And he had listened to it, and he really liked it. And Billy Rosenfield said to Mark, you should listen to these guys. So we had the Margot connection. She had produced Hairspray with Mark and Michael Lynn at New Line. They had this big success, and we basically said, what can we work on together? And that's how The Wedding Singer came up. And because it was a project that Chad and I thought was inherently musical. We both grew up in the 80s. That music, you know, it was the, you know, the besides cast albums, I also happened to listen, you know, I knew my 80s music as well. And we also just loved the story and had a great heart to it. So we had, you know, having virtually no credits, we had to work for it, and we had to write songs on spec.
Yeah, there was an audition process.
Yeah, there was an audition process, and the first thing that had to happen was that the guy who wrote the movie, a guy named Tim Curley, who had written a lot of stuff with Adam Sandler, the head writer of Saturday Night Live, he was very interested in being involved in it, and he had to sign off on it. So we just had a meeting in the New Line conference room, and within 5 seconds, we knew that we were going to be friends. We just hit it off, and Chad and I wrote, I think, 3 or 4 songs and submitted them to Tim and to Margot and to Michael Lynn and Mark Kaufman. And about 6 months later, they said, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. And that was our kind of thrust into that whole world.
So how did it feel when you actually got to opening night on that one?
Oh, it was thrilling. It was that show was a labor of love for a lot of us. And for us, it was our Broadway debut, but also, you know, we got to work with great artists like John Rando and Rob Ashford and Scott Pask and Brian McDevitt, and I got to work with David Chase for the first time, who's a genius, and a lot of my friends were in the cast, which I was not anticipating. It had nothing to do with me. They earned the job, but it was just a wonderful experience. And also, we had to learn how to write under pressure, because we did a tryout in Seattle, and the reviews were mixed. And we had about 3 weeks to come back and turn things around. And we really rewrote Act One of that show in a really big way in those 3 weeks. And I'm really proud of the work that we did on that show. It really came a long way. And then we opened, and it was a little touch and go at first, but then the Tonys came around, and we got 5 Tony nominations, and then all of a sudden we got a nice bump from our Tony performance, which went really beautifully, and that was the highlight for me. Just, you know, getting nominated was incredible, but sitting in that at Radio City and seeing all your friends up there sing a song you wrote, it's pretty cool.
But tell me about your process. Are you music first? Tell me about how you guys write.
We do a lot of talking first about the whole show. We try to have an outline of the whole evening first. We did that on Wedding Singer, and we did that on Elf, and we've done it on our, we certainly did that on Prime. Try to pick the moments that we think we'll sing, and having the whole outline before we write everything, for me at least, makes it easy for me to have a musical shape. So you don't have 3 ballads in a row, so you kind of can figure out what the tempos of each song is, so the evening has a good shape to it.
What makes a moment sing in a musical? Like, what are those moments?
I think, you know, it is that moment where speaking won't get across the emotion anymore. You just get to the point where the emotion gets so high that you just have to break out into song or into dance. And I think you just have to feel what those moments are. I always think musicals can be, there's nothing like a great musical. There's also nothing like a musical that's not done well, because you feel the breaks get when the music starts and the brakes feel like they just got turned on, that's like my life's goal to avoid. You know, always trying to make each song continue the story, you know, develop the plot going or develop character. You just have to make sure the story continues and you're just not stopping to sing a pretty song. That's when I think, you know, shows can falter. But, so we work really hard to make sure that the momentum is continuing to push through.
And is there, what's the big difference between adapting something like The Wedding Singer or Elf or your first show, or not your first show, but Rhythm Club was an original idea?
Yeah.
Is it, do you find it more challenging to adapt when there's a foundation or less challenging because there is that foundation?
Well, I think when you're adapting something, there is always that framework. You can always go back to the original source material and say, all right, what did they do here? Why did they do it? How can we make this our own? But it's still always there. When you're doing something from scratch, there are no limitations. So that in many ways, I think it makes it more difficult, but ultimately it can make it more rewarding when there are characters that you completely made up in your head that have never existed before and people are in the audience are being moved by them. So I think it's probably more challenging to do something that's totally original, but adapting something ain't so easy either.
So Wedding Singer happened, mm-hmm. Elf happened, mm-hmm. You have two big shows on Broadway, they're being done, Wedding Singer especially, I'm sure, is done all over the
country. Yeah, we've had over 1,000 productions. We're actually going next week to the Leicester Curve because they're starting a big, really extensive tour of Wedding Singer. So Chad, Tim, and I are getting on a plane on Saturday to go check it out. We're excited.
That's amazing. So you get these shows up, you get them out there, and now, mm-hmm. So that's it, right? Life's easy. You get lots of other opportunities coming your way. You're a big Broadway composer now.
If only it worked that way. You know, it's great to have shows here. I think the goal is to continue to be able to work on that level. And in many ways, you always have to start over a bit. And I don't think it gets a little easier because people at least can go on iTunes and listen to your work. So they at least know that you've been here before. And especially if your show has made money somewhere, they'll listen. But, getting a show on Broadway, it's very challenging, even for, you know, people who are far more experienced than me.
You find yourself still having to promote yourself or market? Like, what do you do?
I mean, I think it's I should probably be more aggressive about it. Some people are really fantastic with it. I'm getting more active on social media and I finally have my own website so I can be in charge of what people see. I do think it's important to get yourself out there. I have a great agent who also, you know, represents a lot of great writers and I'm very happy to be in that camp. And I've met a lot of wonderful producers and I get pitched ideas often. But my thing is right now is I know the show's going to take 5 to 7 years before it really gets anywhere, if it gets anywhere. So I really want to be sure that it's something I'm just so excited about that I'm jumping out of my skin to get up in the morning and work on it every day. And I think that's not easy to find. So the two shows I'm working on right now, I feel that way about. I'm waiting. I have a couple of things that might happen, but I'm not sure yet. But I think you're always having to start over after a show's open. But I think that's sort of what's exciting about it. But it certainly is getting to Broadway is fantastic. Staying on Broadway is what the goal is.
And you've worked with a number of different types of producers in your career.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a great producer to you?
I think somebody who provides you with the resources that you need to do the work that you need to do, whether it's giving you a studio for a couple of weeks to just work, maybe semi-stage something, do a 29-hour reading. I also think it's really helpful when you have contractual deadlines because you have to do it by a certain date. I just think any structure is good. And when you're in the middle of the creative process, I think it's helpful when producers can, you know, say, look at this area. This area doesn't feel right. Some people think, you know, I haven't really worked with producers who've done this, but I know people who have that will tell you this is what you need to do. This is how you fix it. And I find that I'm not sure if that is as helpful. And also I think notes should really come through one person. I've been involved in shows where there are lots of producers. So you got lots of people in your ear and they don't always have the same opinion. So and you want to serve them all and you want them to be happy, but you also want to have a focused note so you know how to address it.
So I called you one of the young guns of Broadway, one of the rising superstars. Mm-hmm. You got a couple shows out there already. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I'm sure there'll be many more to come. But in your peer group of all mm-hmm. the other guys and girls that are out there doing your thing, are you guys all friends? Is there a budding networking group? Like, do you hang out with them?
Yeah, I have spent a lot of time at events with Tom Kitt, Nell Benjamin, who I'm writing halftime with, Larry O'Keefe, who's her husband. I see Bobby and Kristen all the time. You know, we all have the same agent, so we're all kind of in Team Bizetti. So we all have become friendly through this kind of network of people and Lin-Manuel, and you know, it's like this amazing group of people, and we have all become friendly, and it's really fun. And then you get to, you know, I'm so happy for them when they have these great successes, and they're good people, and everybody, you know, in this gang, everybody's in it for the right reasons, and they just love what they do, and sometimes it's humbling to be in that company.
You talked a little bit about getting pitched ideas. Mm-hmm. Do you prefer to have ideas come to you or for you to come up with your own? I mean, do you Google for, like, I need a musical idea?
We've all done it. Chad and I have spent so many hours in bookstores just saying, what can we do? What can we do? But either way is fine for me. As long as the idea sparks and feels like it can be, it feels musical, it feels like there's a reason for these characters to sing, then I'm on board for checking that. I don't care who you come from.
Is there something specific besides the can it sing? Is there a type of story that works? Or actually a better question is, can anything be a musical?
I think it's all in the execution. I mean, everybody, you know, points to Sweeney Todd. Who the heck ever would have thought that would work? But it's one of the greatest musicals ever written. My personal opinion, and I think my taste, is just to go for the fish out of water story. A main character who doesn't quite fit in and finds themselves and changes everybody around them in the process of the show. That's usually what I'm attracted to. That's certainly what Buddy the Elf is. That's certainly, in a way, what Robbie Hart is in Wedding Singer. And that is definitely what the characters are in our upcoming shows. I like writing about the outcast and having them triumph somehow.
I'm just scrolling through my mind and thinking about how many classic musicals follow that model. So that's some great advice there. Okay, my last question, which is my genie question. Mm-hmm. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to see you and knock on your door and wants to thank you for all your contributions to the musical theater world so far and grant you one wish. Mm-hmm. What's the one thing that makes you so angry, that pisses you off, that really has you flipping tables, throwing your baton, whatever, you know, smashing your keyboard down, that you'd ask this genie to wish away?
I wish we could double the amount of theaters we have in the city.
Says the man with two shows
exactly.
Just waiting.
I know. I'm sure it's not, that's not the most original answer I'm sure you've gotten, but it is true. It's crazy. I've never seen it like this. It's really, there's a jam, and there are great shows that, you know, have to wait, and there are great shows that, you know, hopefully won't be able to be seen, but there's a serious, real estate jam, and it's great for the business. But I wish there were a few more empty ones to allow some new shows to come in, because we're having these shows now that run for 5-10 years. There's so little turnover that it's hard, especially for a moderate sized musical, to get a shot. So it's a tough one.
Certainly, I've got one of those moderate sized musicals myself that's waiting in line.
Yeah.
But you're such a great example of that, because when you got started, you were an unknown. No credits.
Yeah.
And you had a theater for the Rhythm Club.
Yeah. And yes.
And now.
Yeah.
You've got Broadway credits, Tony nominations,
yeah.
A rave review out of town.
Yeah.
And you've got two shows.
Yeah. And we just have to wait and see where everything lies. And it's when I have to, you know, just meditate and think about what's next, because I can't control it.
Yeah, so what, I mean, I can't control it either. So what do you do besides meditate? Do you do another project? Do you?
Yeah, I'm actively looking for another project. I like to kind of write smaller little things, you know, a song cycle here. I always do in the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, I've done the opening number for Broadway Bears, which is always fun. It's kind of like this huge 50-person, 8-minute events that I'm working with Jerry and Nick Hankel, though he's great. So I try to do smaller projects, and I've dabbled a little bit in TV and film, which I like. And I also like that once you're hired, you know what's actually happening. And you know that there's a date where it has to be done, and then that's it, and you kiss it goodbye. I am actively looking for what's next, and I am considering a couple of things right now. And it's getting to be that time where hopefully one or both of these shows, and I think announcements will be happening soon, and we'll be able to move on. I'll be able to move on to whatever the next is. The next thing is and start from scratch.
My fingers are crossed for you. Thank you so much, sir, for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to all of you for listening. Tune in next time. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you then. Bye.
Don't forget, if you're enjoying the podcast, do me a favor, email it to one friend, at least one friend that loves the theater, and let's spread the word about the theater all over the world. Thanks. I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway, here I come.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.